and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House's escalating effort to gin up a crisis on the southern border in order to justify Trump keeping the government shut down until he gets his border wall. John Storr, a fellow at the Yale Journalism Initiative and Yale's Ezra Stiles College, and the editor and publisher of the editorial board, who is a contributing writer to the Washington Monthly, joins us. We'll discuss Trump's call to the major TV networks for an address to the nation at 9 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, as well as his announcement he is visiting the border on Thursday for what White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tweeted is a meeting, quote, with those on the front lines of the national security and humanitarian crisis. We will discuss how Trump's government shutdown is just the latest, if not the biggest, reality TV phony drama he has served up as a distraction in his government by daily stunts to disguise the obvious that Trump can't govern. We will also discuss the looming danger that he will take his shutdown stunt and the manufactured crisis to justify it to the limit and declare a national emergency, and assess the unusual danger that having a weak strongman in the Oval Office constantly projecting phony strength to his base poses, and what might happen when Trump's base tires of his stunts and realizes their tough guy leader is a weakling. Then we will speak with Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School, who recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and is currently meeting with the economic advisors to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, now known as AOC. He joins us to discuss AOC's appearance Sunday on 60 Minutes and how she introduced to the nation an uncontroversial plan to raise taxes on incomes above $10 million to 70%, which has Republicans fulminating. Since under Eisenhower, the top earners paid 91% marginal tax rate, which was lowered to 70% under Kennedy and Johnson, AOC's tax plan would take us back to Reagan's first term before he lowered the top rate to 50% in 1986. It is now at 37%. Then finally, we'll discuss the fate of an 18-year-old Saudi woman trying to escape from Sharia law who was grabbed by Saudi officials in Thailand on her way to Australia and was facing what she saw as certain death if returned to her family in Saudi Arabia. Sarah Lee Whitson, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, joins us to discuss how this brave young woman who barricaded herself in a hotel room in Bangkok is now in the hands of the UNHCR and why she has good reason to fear being deported from Thailand. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is John Storr, who is a fellow at the Yale Journalism Initiative, an associate fellow at Yale's Ezra Stiles College, and editor and publisher of the editorial board. He is a contributing writer to the Washington Monthly and the Connecticut Mirror, as well as a columnist for the New Haven Register. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Storr.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, last time we spoke, you had an article about how the Democrats should stress that Trump doesn't know how to govern and that they should stress his incompetence. But now we have, you know, a quarter of the government shut down, the possibility he's going to declare a national emergency, which gives him enormous powers, you know, dictatorial type of powers. And he's about to make a national address on Tuesday and go down to the border on Thursday. So the country's now being manipulated in a reality TV phony drama. There is no crisis, but he's making a crisis because he wants to distract us again from the fact that he can't govern. So I, for the life of me, don't understand why the loyal opposition in this country who now control the House can't get their act together and let the American people know who they're dealing with in the White House, that this whole government shutdown is a phony reality TV stunt.
Yeah, I would disagree respectfully that the Democrats aren't saying those things. The reason that it doesn't sound like the Democrats are speaking with one voice is because the Democrats don't speak with one voice. You know, because they're Democrats. They are a bunch of liberals who often bicker with one another about this and that, and also, you know, a lot of attention is being paid to kind of intra-party tensions that tend to come to the surface after they achieve some kind of measure of power, which is the case now that they have the House. But at the same time, I'm not sure Trump. I think it's an open question whether Trump is distracting us from the fact that he can't govern. I mean, on the one hand, yes, some people are going to be distracted from the fact that he can't govern. But on the other hand, his efforts to distract us are merely going to compound what people already believe to be true about him, which is that he can't govern. I think this is just his effort to get on national television and lie to the American people is another way for him to do what he does, which is to divide people, right? And, you know, when you're president of the United States, you are not going to achieve whatever it is that you want to achieve by being divisive. You just can't. You're not going to get, unless your party controls every branch of the government, which was previously the case, you're not going to be able to do that. And even when they did control every branch of the government, they still couldn't achieve very much. Why? Because President Trump cannot govern. And the Republicans cannot govern. The Republicans are very good at winning power. They're not good at deciding what to do with that power or get organized enough to govern in the way that most ordinary people would think is fair and legitimate. The Democrats have the reverse problem, which is that they're very good at governing. It's the getting elected part that's hard. So that's what I would offer as my opening gambit.
Well, he's already made it clear, though, in his meetings with the Democrats, with Schumer and Pelosi, apparently he confessed, in effect, that he wants this extra $5 billion so that he won't lose face with his base, having made this absurd promise of a wall that Mexico would pay for. And essentially, it's very clear, and the reason he reversed himself last time was because he got criticism from Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh. So can't somebody point out that this government shutdown, with all of these government workers not being paid, and it's going to get worse, and maybe people won't get their tax refunds, and airports now are getting clogged up because TSA people, quite understandably, are calling in sick and not getting paid. This Coast Guard can't even protect the damn border, which is what the whole shutdown's about. So, I mean, at least, you know, start calling it the Coulter-Limbaugh shutdown.
Well, Schumer and Pelosi have been doing a pretty good job, I think, of calling it the Trump shutdown. And another thing, too, is that the Democrats, even in the Senate, you know, a lot of people, for good reason, I think, you know, give Chuck Schumer a hard time because he's basically like ready to bargain and give away the store if he can achieve something. And there's a lot to be said about Schumer as having a spine of jelly. But on the other hand, I think he's doing a pretty good job this time. He's calling it. He has all the leverage, first of all. So his job is made easier, I suppose. He has all the leverage, and he has all the incentive to keep saying no, to such a degree that some of his, at least two of the Democratic senators whose names escape me at the moment, have said that there will be no debating any legislation in the Senate unless it's related to reopening the government. And Schumer just this morning said, yes, that's what we're going to do. We're going to have a total blockade of all legislation that's not related to the government. And unless it's legislation that requires just a simple majority, that means the Senate has been shut down. So that's a really, you know, for those of us who are worried about the president, you know, running over democracy, that's a very good sign, right, that the Democrats, especially, you know, even in the Senate where they don't have a lot of power, are using what power they can to shut things down.
So, but already one wonders about whether or not, you talk about Schumer having a spine of jelly. What about McConnell? Does he have a spine at all? Because he's not standing up for the United States Constitution. You could make the case that Trump is already in violation of the U.S. Constitution because he's forcing the American people to pay for a wall that he promised Mexico would pay for, and he's going to shut down the government until he gets his way. If they accept that precedent, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you accept the precedent that the executive branch can blackmail the legislative branch at will in order to get their way, that's no way to run a railroad. That's a terrible precedent.
Yeah, well, it's terrible. That's right. Well, McConnell, he's an open question, I think, whether he's, on the one hand, I think he's going to cave any minute now. And on the other hand, I think he will just do whatever Donald Trump says. I'm not sure. I think his caucus, his Republicans in the Senate will feel more and more pressure, especially Republican senators in states that get a lot of attention from the federal government, and what I'm talking about is farm states and states that where lots of land is managed by the federal government. I think they're going to start feeling pressure. Will McConnell bend? I don't know. He's a pretty bloodless kind of guy. You know, he's the guy who decided that the Supreme Court can function just fine with eight justices. So we thought that was unthinkable. So the shutdown could go on for some time. As far as violation of the Constitution, I don't know about that. But the fact is that most people, most of the time in America, don't know what's right and what's wrong about politics. What they do know is that is the government running as it should be, or is it not running as it should be? You know, they know those kinds of things, and this is not condescending or anything. I just think it's reality. And most people, even if they're like, well, maybe we should have a wall, maybe we shouldn't have a wall, most people are going to be like, why are we shutting down the government for this wall thing? You know, why are we doing that? Most people, I think, most of the time, can understand that the president is holding the government to ransom and saying, give me the money or the girl gets it. that's basically what most people are seeing right now. So even as he's going back to distractions, even as he's trying to distract from the fact that he can't govern, he's trying to distract from the fact that he's actually a very weak president, he's proving the point. So, will this end well? Probably not, but he will get the blame, as will the Republicans.
But there is a worse shoe to drop, and that is he's already mentioned twice that he's considering declaring a national emergency. He did it last Thursday, and he did it again on Sunday. And I don't know whether this national address he's planning on Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, is going to be about declaring a national emergency or threatening to declare a national emergency. But I had a legal expert from the Brennan Center at NYU who wrote a piece in the Atlantic, Elizabeth Goitein, which was a most alarming piece because it basically tells you the enormous powers that Trump assumes if he were to declare a national emergency. And these powers are kind of the powers that the dictators around the world that Trump so admires already have. So I think we could be in for a much worse situation. So how much would that change the calculus if he were to declare a national emergency?
Well, you have to have a national emergency to declare a national emergency, first of all. Second, he has to make the case to Congress, the legal case, that he's justified in invoking these powers. So right there, one and two, he's got a problem, right? Yes, the Republican Party, especially Fox News and the right-wing media universe, is going to ramp up the tension, and everything's always an emergency for these people, so therefore, the president needs to invoke unitary powers. It's a bunch of nonsense. People know that it's not an emergency. Fact is, if you're going to build a wall along a 2,000-mile stretch, that's going to take a decade at least. Where's the emergency there exactly? Emergencies are something that are happening right now, right? You're building a wall over a decade is not it undermines the whole notion of what a national emergency is. So right there, he's got a problem. Second, if he tries to, you know, any president can try to, all presidents try to exert as much power as they can, right? So that's just a fact. Second, it's up to other institutions to contain those presidents. And in fact, is Congress, which is now half run by the Democrats, can say, no, you cannot do that. You know, we have something to say about that. And plus, you know, it'll immediately get locked up in the courts. I mean, he rescinded DACA, which is the, you know, deferred action for childhood arrivals for kids who were brought here as kids who were brought here by their parents when they entered the country illegally. Trump rescinded that, but within, you know, a week, I don't remember the timeline, but very shortly after rescinding it, it was locked up in the courts, and it's been there ever since. And to the point now where he can't use that as leverage anymore because the Democrats say it's safely locked up in the courts probably up until 2020. So you know, even if he does invoke these powers, he's going to be challenged right away, and once again, he will box himself in. Demonstrate the thing that he's actually the most fearful of, which is that he will be shown to be weak, not just to people who already got his number. You know, the rest of us, we already figured out that he's weak. I figured out within 2 months that he couldn't govern, right? But it's the people he most needs to support him and to keep his poll numbers up and to probably keep him out of prison. Those people are the ones he's scared to death will figure out that he's really weak. This thing about the wall is about the wall, like they really want it, but really it's about showing that he's strong. And if there's one thing that this Republican base cannot tolerate, it's a weak leader. If once they sniff him out and figure out that he's weak, they'll just chew him up. And that's what happened with George Bush. By 2007, he was chewed up. You know, it was done. They were done with him. And no, I'm not going to bet money, Ian, because I'm not a betting person. But I think the likelihood of that scenario playing out is very high.
Well, today, Sarah Sanders tweeted out that President Donald Trump will travel to the southern border on Thursday to meet with those on the front lines of the national security and humanitarian crisis. More details mm-hmm. will be announced soon. So we know that he sent down the troops to the border and he tried to gin up a big crisis with the caravan from Central America as an election ploy, and it may have worked to some extent. But those troops are still down there. And I don't see a national clamor to pull them out. In fact, the whole point is that he's probably going to add to them. He's going to probably send down thousands more if he can. I mean, as commander-in-chief, he can actually do that. So I think he's put himself in a position where I've always argued that the American people will abandon this guy once they see who he really is. And the people on the inside of the White House see it every day. They see this crazy guy running around ranting and watching television and getting upset and sulking and calling up his friends and stuff. That's who we have. But we haven't seen that in public. And I've often referred to what happened when the Nixon tapes were revealed. The scales came off the eyes of many Americans. My God, our president curses and swears. That's nothing compared to, I think, what will happen if there's a national awakening about this weak, incompetent man that we have in the Oval Office. So he's sort of putting himself into that dangerous territory, as you pointed out, I think. But he's not without, you know, some weapons. You know, he's got.
No, that's absolutely right. That's a great point to emphasize for your audience, Ian, is that a weak president, even though it might be, you know, we might laugh or, you know, breathe a sigh of relief because he's weak, it's actually the reverse. A weak president is a very dangerous president. And, you know, the way I'm talking is about political calculations and what people are going to end up seeing, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality, I'm more worried about these knee-jerk decisions that he makes than some kind of, you know, than him evoking emergency powers and becoming a dictator. I'm not, that, you know, that could happen, but the the most problematic thing is just him being Trump, being Trump, and being just a dangerous person. And the more he feels caged in, the more he will lash out, right? So the closer we get to what might be a resolution to this tragedy that we're experiencing, or travesty, I guess is a better word, this travesty that we're experiencing, the closer we will also get to the real danger. And then there'll be a breaking point. I keep trying to guess in writing the editorial board, like when that will be. And I keep, finding myself wrong about when that will be. I think, well, maybe it'll be this year, maybe it'll be next year. I don't know. But we know the point is coming. I mean, there's just too many variables are starting to box this president in, right? And we can see him behaving as if he were boxed in. So the challenge is to predict, what good things will happen, but what bad things will happen as a result.
So given that Donald Trump has said on a number of occasions that federal workers, the ones that we see now, like the TSA people calling in sick and the Coast Guard and the IRS, and we're getting into the season where people start filing their returns and expecting a much-needed refund, he's saying on time and again, lying, that government workers support his shutdown and support him. So the question would be, does he actually believe that lie or not? Because this is what I'm trying to figure out is, whether he is delusional or whether he's clever.
That's the big question. That's the question a lot of us have been asking since the beginning of this. I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, he's not terribly intelligent, but I don't think he's a moron either. I think he's a good con man, right? And he hasn't gotten this far as a con artist without being good at it. But does he really believe it? I think also, yes, that's true. I mean, if you think about what one of the things that makes salespeople successful is that they really believe what they're saying, right? So that whatever they're saying, even if it's a lie, is not really a lie because they believe it's true. See what I mean?
Right.
And I think I think it's a little bit of both, which I don't know if that makes that's not very comforting to think that he really believes these lies. I think somebody's just feeding him. I think he extrapolates. One or two people say good job, and he equates that with everybody who's in the federal government, working in the federal government. he looks for anything that bolsters his point of view, right? The problem is that he's categorically intellectually dishonest, right? There is no fact. He does not ever defer to the authority of a fact, because there is no authority higher than his own preferences and his own ego, right? So even if I say the sky is blue, he'll say, no, the sky is not blue because I say it's not blue, even if it's blue. So that's the problem, and that's, by the way, your audience should know, if they don't already, that that's what makes him impossible to negotiate with. You can't come to a bargain with somebody whose read on reality keeps slipping around, right? Because you can't trust him to follow through with whatever it is that he said he's going to do, right? You just can't do that. That's why Nancy Pelosi keeps that wonderful episode in the Oval Office that was televised nationally, where he owned the shutdown, before the shutdown. And she said to him at one point, what the president is saying, this is not a quote, but what the president's saying about the cards that he's holding are not factually accurate. She said something to that effect. And what she was saying is, the president says he has leverage in negotiating with the Democrats after the midterms, but the president is factually incorrect. The president has no leverage, right? But a guy who continues to believe that he has leverage will just say and do anything, right? And the result is what we have, a government shutdown for no particular reason that anybody can make heads or tails of.
But therein, John Storer, is another narrative that I feel the Democrats should seize on, and I'm not sure that they are, and that is, and indeed the Republicans in the Senate should also seize on it, which is, who can you negotiate with? First of all, you're negotiating with a man who doesn't have the facts, who gets his facts from Alex Jones or Fox News, or lately, apparently, from these Border Patrol union officials who you saw in a photo op with him, these big burly guys with skinheads. They apparently spend an awful lot of time in the White House. Stephen Miller brings them in, and they're whispering in Trump's ear around the clock. So he's getting filled with most ridiculous, paranoid stuff about the border. So problem number one is you can't negotiate with somebody who can't agree upon a set of basic facts to begin a negotiation. And two, if you do get an agreement out of Trump, a minute later, Ann Coulter and Limbaugh complain about it, he'll reverse himself.
That's right. And there is no answer to this question. He's unfit. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. The guy who is running the largest employer in the United States, the federal government, cannot be trusted to honor his promises unless it's for his, quote-unquote, his people, right? He is president of the Republican Party, right? He's not president of the United States. And, you know, if you were to ask me, if I were to say that during the Bush era, I would have felt a little queasy about saying that, you know, George Bush is not the president of the United States, because I didn't like the guy and I didn't like his policies, but he was the president of the United States. I don't feel any qualms saying that about Trump. He does not hide the fact that the only people he cares about is the choir that he preaches to every day on Twitter.
Well, John Storer, I thank you very much for joining us and appreciate the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with John Storer, who's a fellow at the Yale Journalism Initiative, an associate fellow at Yale's Ezra Stiles College, an editor and publisher of The Editorial Board. He is a contributing writer to The Washington Monthly and The Connecticut Mirror, as well as a columnist for the New Haven Register. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's uncontroversial plan to raise taxes on incomes above $10 million to 70%.
That's worked out pretty well so far. But when they see the kind of person that you really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing so hard.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, who is also a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. He's also recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and he is meeting with the economic advisors for Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Hi, Ian. Happy New Year. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Robert. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was on 60 Minutes on Sunday. I think it's a very useful thing that she's floating the idea across the country that you can raise the taxes on people earning more than $10 million to the 70% level, which is, by the way, lower than what a lot of prominent economists, including Peter Diamond, the Nobel laureate, are suggesting. They are even suggesting 73%. So what was your impression? Because my impression was that in spite of the efforts of the right wing and Fox and the Breitbart, etc., to paint her as a wild, bomb-throwing leftist loony, she came across as a sensible consensus builder.
I thought she did, too, Ian. I thought I was actually quite heartened by this. I mean, there were a couple of senses in which I think she did this, right? The first is, you know, people sort of forget. I mean, the highest marginal tax rate during the Eisenhower years, and last I checked, Eisenhower was a Republican, was 91%, right? So she's basically proposing, as a possibility at least, going back literally to the Reagan tax code. that was what the top marginal rate was when Reagan took office for the first part of his administration. So that's the first sense in which I think she sort of showed that there's nothing particularly radical about this. The second sense is that she didn't say that she necessarily thinks that we'll have to raise the taxes. She just says that we should be ready to do that. We should be prepared to do that if it comes to that. But she's pointed out another important part of the interview that I think a lot of people sort of overlooked, was she said, look, we will fund the Green New Deal in the same way that we fund everything else. For example, Trump's $1.5 trillion tax giveaway this time last year, and of course the Bush $1 trillion tax giveaway and various other giveaways. Nobody talked about how we fund those. We just fund them in the usual way, which is to say we don't fund them at all. We just sort of, you know, get along and get along with issuing more Treasury securities as our primary mode of financing. So she's sort of suggesting that, look, you know, we can just kind of continue in the same way, but just use those expenditures on something that's more worthwhile than tax cuts for people at the top of the distribution.
So under Eisenhower, as you mentioned, Robert Hockett, top earners paid 91% marginal rate, and it fell to 70% under Kennedy and Johnson. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Reagan inherited that, but he took it down to 50% with his first big tax cut, and then down to 38% with the 1986 tax reform, which, although it did give the rich a big break, it also closed a lot of loopholes. So there's the history. So there's nothing radical about 70%. But
no,
do you think it's a mistake, though, to have it tied to something called the Green New Deal? I mean, in other words, wouldn't the argument be that the working and middle-class Americans are just being hosed? They haven't had a raise since the late 1970s. They need a break, and the rich simply, like a Mark Zuckerberg, simply doesn't know what to do with the extra billions he's earning every year. So,
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, the people at the top, they do sort of know what to do with it. They don't consume it. They put it into the financial markets. And, of course, people often talk about how we haven't had an inflation problem over the last 30 or 40 years. They always talk about the so-called Great Moderation. But they conveniently ignore the regular hyperinflations that we've had in the asset markets, right, the financial markets. Where do you think all that money chasing too few goods, as the expression has it, comes from? It's from the top. The reason we've had so much financial volatility over the last 30, 40 years is precisely because the money has migrated to the top of the distribution. You don't really want to buy a 10th yacht. You don't get much when you have a 9th yacht already. You don't get much more marginal utility from your 10th than you got from your 9th. So you put it into the financial markets. So one way of looking at what Representative Ocasio-Cortez and other New Dems are trying to do is say, look, let's bring that distribution back into line with some kind of sustainable, sane degree of income and wealth distribution of the sort that we used to have, right, during the Eisenhower years, during the Kennedy years, during the Johnson years, that people tend to look back to fondly. And that would be one way to do that, of course.
So is there also another way, Robert, to focus on the need for revenues because of these, you know, the last tax cut blew out the deficit? And we know the Republicans have really ravaged the IRS over the years, cut its funding. Mm-hmm. They don't collect what they should be collecting. They basically have to harass, you know, working and middle-class Americans, auditing them where the rich just simply don't get audited. I don't know what the figures are, but just hiring a few more IRS people and stopping the bleeding of the IRS by the Republican Congress would bring in X trillions. I don't know what the figure are, but I'd like to get some of these figures from you because there are indications. I think Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, 70% after you earn your first $10 million, that, I believe, could bring in an extra $72 billion a year. So that's $720 billion over 10 years. In the overall scheme of things, not a lot of money. There's not a lot you can do, let alone the Green New Deal. So why not start looking for other areas? You know, the corporate tax rate got lowered from 35. Clearly, the revenues haven't come in as promised. So take it back to 35. That would bring in some extra money. So Is there any sort of global plan to lay out these figures to let us all know how much more the government could be taking in just under simple fairness?
Yeah. So at the present, I don't think there is any such plan. And there's a very simple reason for that. And that is that Representative Ocasio-Cortez sort of understands that taxation really isn't so much about raising revenue as it's about fighting inflation in the event that there is too much public expenditure in connection with too much private expenditure, right? In other words, the real constraint on federal expenditures when we're, of course, spending our own currency that we ourselves issue, the real constraint is the inflation constraint. In other words, you can spend as much as you need until it looks like there's too much money out there chasing too few goods, and if prices are rising too quickly, then you have to clamp down on inflation. But as we know, right, there's been no sign of inflation in this economy for a good long time now. And indeed, as you know, the Fed has been trying for the last 10 years to get the inflation rate up to 2% so as to ward off the prospect of deflation, right? In other words, deflation is much worse than inflation. And for that very reason, the Fed has targeted a 2% inflation rate over the last decade, and we've barely ever made that rate. It's always been below that rate. So what that means is we have a lot of leeway to spend more without endangering ourselves with excess inflation at this point. There's just that much slack in the economy. So what Representative Ocasio-Cortez is saying is, look, we are prepared to tax in the right places if at some point we really do have to start raising taxes to ward off inflation. But for right now, there is no looming inflation problem. And indeed, if anything, there's been a looming deflation problem. So for that reason, there's not a global plan so far to sort of look for revenue hither and yon. I'm quite sure and quite confident that she will develop such a plan if that need were to arise. But at this point, again, after 10 years of looking for a 2% rate and still not reaching it, that's not anywhere in prospect. One other quick thing on this, Ian, another way to check what the markets anticipate in the way of inflation is to see if there's a spread between so-called inflation indexed treasury bonds or TIPS on the one hand and regular treasuries on the other hand. There's almost no spread between the two, meaning that the markets as a whole don't anticipate or see any looming inflation problem on the horizon. And that suggests, again, that Representative Ocasio-Cortez would not actually see a need to raise taxes in the foreseeable future. So I think what she was doing last night was telling us where she would look for more tax revenue if indeed it became necessary to take some money out of the economy. But at present, she doesn't, I don't think, see that as an imminent threat.
But you were saying earlier, Robert Hockett, that the wealthy put their excess money that they can't spend, the billions of extras. You said you can't, there's no point in having a ninth yacht, and you can't sail nine yachts at one time at any rate. Right. So what about stopping that inflation that you said was one of the most dangerous drivers on Wall Street? Yeah. What about a 0.1? The CBO actually found that a 0.1% financial transaction tax on Wall Street would raise an additional $780 billion over 10 years. So it seems like there are all kinds of little pots of money out there that could go to better use, infrastructure, the Green New Deal, Medicare
That's
for
true.
All.
You know, that's true. Yeah. And as you remember, Senator Sanders was all in favor of a Wall Street transaction tax, partly for that reason. And I believe that Representative Ocasio-Cortez would probably be amenable to that, too. I can't say that I've talked to her about it. So I don't want to put words into her mouth. But my guess would be that she would actually look favorably upon something like that, at least if it looked like it was necessary to address a bubble or a renewed bubble in this or that financial market. And as we know, right, stocks do seem to have been overvalued for quite some time. The P.E. ratios do not appear to warrant the prices the stocks have been at over the last couple of years. And so it could very well be that it's worth bringing those down a little bit because they're unsustainable. I guess we'll see. But at least things don't look quite as crazy as they did in the mortgage-backed securities markets circa 2007 and 2008.
So how about selling this then to the American people? I think it's very important that somebody actually broke that taboo and spoke about the idea of raising taxes in a substantial rather than a kind of incremental. And I mean, what was the difference between the 39% and the 36%? I mean, going back to 39, that's nothing. She's talking about a real tax reform, if you will. But already Steve Scalise, for example, is tweeting out, Republicans let Americans keep more of their own hard-earned money. Democrats take away 70% of your income and give it to leftist fantasy programs. So you know that's going to be the line of attack. The obvious answer to that is that's nonsense. We're not talking about letting Americans keep more of their own hard-earned money. We're talking about the 0.1% of Americans not just getting more money than what you got four or five families owning half of the wealth of the country.
Yeah. So you probably saw Alex's response to Scalise's tweet, which is terrific. She said, "How is it that you don't know how marginal income taxation works?" Which was, I think, a very apt question, right? The idea of a marginal tax, of course, is you tax that 70% against income above the margin. And if she says, okay, look, it kicks in at 10 million, that means, you know, you're not subject to the 70% tax on the 10 million. You're subject to the 70% tax after the 10 million, which I think it's probably safe to say means after your 10th yacht. That's the first point worth making. The second worth making that you opened with, I think, is especially important, the breaking of the taboo. So you and I are old enough to remember that before the occupation of Wall Street in 2011, there was a real taboo against talking about inequality. You know, people accused you of engaging in class warfare as if, you know, your objection to the war was itself the war. And of course, what the occupiers did immediately is blew all of that completely out of the water, and it became safe to talk about equality and inequality again. And I think that one of the things that Alexandria has done is now basically blown the lid off another taboo and said, look, if the time comes that we have to raise taxes, and it could well come, then we really ought to be ready to do it in the right way, the way that we used to do it during decades of sane Republican administration of government and decades of sane Democratic administration of government. And that doesn't mean going back to like a piddling little 36 or 38% marginal rate on those who are earning over $10 million. It means something more like what we had, you know, again, during those Kennedy or Johnson years, or even during the Eisenhower years. And I think she's performed a great service in putting that back on the table, reintroducing that, in effect, to our political vocabulary.
Well, Robert Hockett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School. He's also a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislatures and local governments. He recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently meeting with the economic advisors to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the fate of an 18-year-old Saudi woman who was grabbed by Saudi officials in Thailand and was facing what she saw as certain death if returned to her family in Saudi Arabia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Lee Whitson, who's the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. And she's published widely on human rights issues in the Middle East in international and regional media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Lee Whitson.
Hi.
So, Sarah, I suppose it's good news that Rahaf Al-Qunun, the young 18-year-old Saudi woman who's been stuck at the airport in Thailand, she's now in the care of the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. But what's happened to her so far is pretty alarming. It shows how much the Saudi diplomatic corps, if you will, are really dedicated to keeping these you know, young Saudi dissidents or anybody that would cross the line that they have drawn in terms of running an incredibly repressive state. That's what struck me, is how quickly they knew about her and how the Saudi consul in Bangkok immediately grabbed her passport. So is there a network there throughout the world of through Saudi diplomats and embassies to keep an eye on any Saudi citizen abroad?
Well, apparently there is. And I mean, this could be episodes straight out of The Handmaid's Tale, the notion that a government would go to such extreme lengths to try to forcibly return an adult woman who has left the country of her own volition back to the country simply because her father and brothers and cousins objected to her traveling is really quite remarkable. But I think it really goes to show the extent to which the Saudi government does not want any woman, not one single woman, to breach the rules, the order, the discipline that they've imposed, that effectively makes them the wards of their male guardians until the day they die.
Well, in this case, this young woman had already been punished by her father for cutting her hair, and apparently she was confined to her room for 6 months.
That is what she's reported, and of course we've heard of several such cases where young women, sometimes children, sometimes adults, choose to live a lifestyle that's not the lifestyle that their parents or husband or brother or cousins even have decided they should live, and can get away with literally detaining them, physically detaining them in the household because, in fact, women's rights are extremely circumscribed by what their male guardian, in this case would be her father, permits. And the fact that she not only cut her hair, but has since declared, since coming to Thailand, that she doesn't want to wear a veil, I can see that being something that many fathers, brothers, and so forth would not tolerate in Saudi Arabia and try to forcibly impose on a woman.
Well, indeed, she also renounced Islam and called herself an atheist, which certainly doesn't help her case inside Saudi Arabia. This is a country pretty unique in the world that actually has Sharia law, and that is under the Sharia law is considered apostasy and therefore punishable by death.
That's right. And there have been, and so this is not just a hypothetical, there are a number of cases, many cases, where people in Saudi Arabia have been sentenced to death, confined to life in prison because they have renounced their faith, declared that they don't believe in God, something that is quite, you know, ordinary. For example, in China, where the whole country is officially atheist, to Saudi Arabia, where it's a crime punishable by death. And of course, that violates a basic norm of international law, of international human rights law, which is freedom of religion. And freedom of religion includes the right not to have a religion, the right to say, I don't believe in any supernatural being or God.
So what's different about this case? Because there was an earlier case where Dina Ali Laslum, 24-year-old, just as this young woman on her way to Australia from Kuwait, Rahaf Al-Kunin, was detained. She was detained in the Philippines, and she was taken back to Saudi Arabia from Manila Airport by her family, and she's never been heard of since. Nobody knows what happened to her once she got back in Saudi Arabia. But she did say that the families would kill her.
Yes, and we understand that she is detained in her home, but we've not been able to have further contact with her. But so, yes, I think the only difference in this case was the effectiveness of the international outcry and the international outrage. There is extraordinary attention focused on Saudi Arabia right now, particularly in the wake of the brutal, savage murder of Jamal Khashoggi, about which the Saudis, of course, tried to lie. And so now there's more opportunity for other persecuted individuals to have their stories heard. In this case, Ms. Lafun had an opportunity to actually flee the country, and that's what made it possible for her to get the protection that she was able to get. It was the pressure brought on by social media, by human rights organizations like ours on the ground in Bangkok, by international media who were present at the hotel, that really made it very difficult for the Thai government to do what it really actually wanted to do, which is to comply with the Saudi demand to return her back to Kuwait, where she would be picked up by her father and returned forcibly to Saudi Arabia.
So it does seem that this young woman, Rahaf Al-Kunin, who was on her way to Australia, she'd been in contact with somebody in Australia. I think her use of social media was pretty smart, wasn't it? I mean, she had somebody that she was able to talk to regularly who was posting stuff for her. She also locked herself in a hotel room and used all the hotel furniture as a barricade to prevent the Thai and Saudis officials from grabbing her and shoving her on the plane back to what she says would be a certain death. So is there something about this spirited young woman that makes her a little different?
Well, obviously, she's extraordinarily brave, extraordinarily courageous, but it's also heartbreaking at the same time that she's forced into such a terrible position, forced to separate herself from her family, from her loved ones, from her friends, from her country, because she has no recourse in Saudi Arabia, because she has no opportunity to have her rights, her safety, her well-being protected in a system that provides parents and male guardians unfettered authority to do what they wish with the women in their custody and in their care. Even women who make it to a domestic violence shelter in Saudi Arabia, which the government was basically forced to create given the spate of domestic violence incidents in the country, are not entirely safe. All a male guardian has to do is sign a pledge saying they will not harm the woman again in order to force the shelter to release her back into their custody. The guardians can retaliate against a woman who goes to a domestic violence shelter by refusing to allow her to leave, by actually not granting permission for her to leave the shelter, so it effectively becomes a detention center. This is not the situation that the Haf should have found herself in. She should have had recourse to protection, to the right to travel, to the right to move out of her family home, to the right to be free from reprisals in her own country. But the Saudi Arabian government has not made that possible for her, and in effect forced her to seek exile abroad.
Well, the Saudi government also, just back to our original discussion about the ubiquitous nature of Saudi intelligence, I guess, being also a part of their diplomatic corps, the fact of the matter is she shouldn't have been detained in Thailand. She had an onward ticket to go to Australia. It seems like they pulled some strings with the Thais to grab her passport and put her in this situation. And it does seem that, in effect, the Thai authorities have been shamed by international media, because now that she's in the hands of the UNHCR, it's worth noting that Thailand is not a signatory to the UN Refugee Convention.
Right. It's not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, but even under customary international law, Thailand would be prohibited, is prohibited from returning someone to a place where they face persecution and torture. So regardless of whether or not they sign the convention, they have international law obligations. But I'm glad to see that they've complied with them. And I'm glad to see that the Thai immigration authorities reversed their position and publicly declared that they would not return her because of the risk of persecution and torture that she faces if she's returned to Saudi Arabia. They were trying to find some little technical gimmicks to detain her and forcibly deport her. But in fact, Saudis are entitled to an entry visa to Thailand at the airport. So it is extraordinary that they made a fuss about that. And of course, she had no intention of remaining in Thailand. She had a ticket onwards to Australia, which is her destination and a place where actually other Saudi women have fled.
So did you know anything about this network of Saudi women in Australia?
Well, I would just say that there are Saudi women in Australia, some Saudi activist women, some Saudi artists who fled to safety there. They are now, in particular, keeping a very low profile because of threats that have been made against their families back in Saudi Arabia.
Well, but one of the threats or one of the leverage that the Saudi government has with these countries is they can threaten trade retaliations. They did that with Canada. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, did that against Canada because of some mild criticism from Canada's foreign minister. So what's going on with this? Yeah, I'm just curious to know why. Have the Saudis promised to retaliate against Australia, or is Australia taking a principal stand? They have a pretty dreadful record on immigration when it comes to refugees trying to arrive in Australia.
That's true. I mean, and it's not entirely certain that Saudi Arabia, or rather that Australia, would give her refuge or recognize an asylum claim for the reasons you just cited, in a downward shift in their policies in that regard, as well as a wish not to annoy or irritate the Saudi Arabian government. But I think Saudi Arabia will continue to find itself an outlier and ostracized in its efforts to punish governments around the world, which are increasing in number, that are, you know, are just doing very basic things. Like when the Canadian foreign minister spoke out, it was because Raif Badawi is married to a Canadian resident. And so she has Canada's interests and the interests of Canada's residents in mind when she urged the government release him and end his unjust detention.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Sarah Lee Whitson, what's likely to change? I mean, our conversation, I think, flies in the face of this notion that Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, was a great reformer. And unfortunately, a lot of prominent American policy people and even journalists seem to have swallowed that line. I take it the Khashoggi brutal murder and dismemberment has basically overshadowed that optimism that this guy was a reformer. How is this playing out in the country? It would indicate to me, if these young women are brave enough to do what they do and risk their lives in this way, there must be an awful lot of desperate women inside that country.
There are, and it's not clear what the government will do in response to the international scorn and the international outrage that its policies continue to generate. Will this mean that the Saudi government lifts the restrictions on women's traveling, recognizing that it's going to continue to run into these situations where adult Saudi women leave the country and someone tries to forcibly return them? I hope so. You know, I hope that the international focus and scrutiny will mean good things for the women of Saudi Arabia and good things for all the people of Saudi Arabia who want to see their country reformed and modernized and see the human rights of its citizens protected. So I hope all of this pressure, I hope the sacrifices that Saudi activists are making in their efforts to bring change to their country, I hope the sacrifice that Jamal Khashoggi made, paying with his life, pays off for the people of Saudi Arabia.
And just in closing, the male guardianship law, is that possibly going to be affected? Is there any talk inside the kingdom of changing the male guardianship law, which means that women need a male relative's permission to work, travel, marry, open a bank account, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, there have already been some significant reforms in the guardianship system. So, for example, technically, women should not have to get a guardian's permission in order to obtain a job. What happens, however, is that employers continue to require it, and women don't really have recourse to insist that they be employed without that permission. So it continues to be informally applied. The two aspects of the guardianship system that remain fully enforced by the government are that a woman has to obtain her guardian's consent in order to marry, and she has to obtain a guardian's consent in order to travel. So these are sort of the biggest controls over women and two of the remnants that we very much hope the government will change.
Well, Sarah Lee Whitson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She's led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. And she has published widely on human rights issues in the Middle East in international and regional media. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.